For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. Taigen, our teacher, is away this evening. He's teaching in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at our affiliate sangha there that's led by Kazan Titus O'Brien, who many of you probably met during the practice commitment period. He was here for a number of weeks. So he asked me to do the talk. I know most of you, but if you don't know me, my name is Laurel Gyoshin. I'm one of several people studying here as priests. And my talk tonight is about the life and the writing of Henry David Thoreau and the connections of his world to Zen practice. So in Zen, we have, our tradition is to learn directly from a teacher or from teachers, and also to honor our ancestors. And Thoreau, of course, was a Christian. He was not a Soto Zen Buddhist practitioner. But we can find our teachers in many different traditions, and he's been an important teacher for me over many decades, ever since I first learned about him as a girl. I grew up in the Unitarian tradition, and we learned about the Transcendentalists, Thoreau and Emerson and Channing and the Alcotts and so forth. And the Transcendentalists taught that divinity is in every one of us and in all of nature. And I liked that, even as a young girl. So they had this philosophy that Thoreau put in many of his writings of living deliberately. And part of what that meant is sort of living while weighing the moral consequences of your actions. So in our memorial service, we chanted the Song of the Grass Hut, and I explained that it was because it was a favorite Zen poem of Penelope Starr. But it's certainly an appropriate poem to precede a Dharma talk about Thoreau, because he's known best for his writings about the 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days that he spent at Walden Pond. And so if he were still alive, he would have celebrated his 200th birthday last Wednesday, and July 12th. And last Monday, Taigen brought us a koan in his talk, in which a monk said something like, my teacher has passed away, but his flesh is still warm. And I sort of think that Thoreau has passed away, but his flesh is still warm. And I think it's even got warmed up because of this 200th anniversary. It got warmed up even more. So on his bicentennial, U of C Press published a major new biography about him, 640 pages. I haven't read it yet, but I've read lots of reviews, many very ecstatically positive reviews about this masterpiece of a biography. The writer of the biography is a woman named Laura Dassow Walls. She's a Notre Dame professor, English professor, so she's nearby. And she's written a lot about Transcendentalists. And she said something like, I didn't find the Thoreau I knew in the biography, so I wrote this one. And the reviewers really admire the work, so I'm really looking forward to reading it. The New York Times Book Review headline said, "On Thoreau's 200th birthday, a new biography pictures him as a man of principle." So that's good, right? One of the most quoted lines is this one. Starts out sort of what you already know. "Moving to Walden Pond thus had a double purpose. It offered a writer's retreat where Thoreau could follow his calling as spiritual seeker, philosopher, and poet." We knew that. This is the interesting part. "And it offered a public stage on which he could dramatize his one-person revolution in consciousness, making his protest a form of performance art." Well, that's so interesting. So in other words, he lived at Walden and wrote about it as a demonstration about his ideas about how to live. And, you know, so he was being a teacher. So she says, "Moving to Walden was a declaration that from then on, Thoreau would be a writer in an entirely new sense. Instead of living a little and then writing about it, his life would be one single integrated act of composition." So, I find that very, very interesting and attractive. Attractive in the sense that I take that as very interesting advice or about how to live a life fully. Reb Anderson, who is Tigan's teacher, wrote a book called Sitting Upright that many of us have read. We all read it when we sew our rakusu. It's one part of our process of taking the precepts. Anyway, he said in that book that when he was in college, he read stories about Zen monks and how, and their great compassion, and he said to himself, "I want to be like that." And he also wrote, "My main motivation in becoming a priest was to be like Suzuki Roshi." So Suzuki Roshi was Reb Anderson's teacher and also the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center and arguably one of the people that was most influential in bringing this kind of practice to North America. And you know, I sort of found these comments really powerful as I was trying to understand how to do this practice myself. So we recite the Bodhisattva vows. We'll do it later tonight. You know, we say, "Beings are numberless. I vow to free them." And then we think to ourselves, "Whoa, that's really hard. How do we do that?" And, you know, there are many ways to think about doing that. Yesterday, Nyozen gave a wonderful talk at our all-day sitting about the Eightfold Bodhisattva Path, right speech, right effort, and so forth. And there are many teachings about this. But one way that that I particularly like or do is to look for bodhisattvas in the world and see how they live their life and use their lives as teachings. So anyway, just a few facts about Thoreau for people that might not be as familiar with him. So I mentioned he was born 200 years ago, July 12th, 1817. He was born in Concord, Massachusetts. He died in Concord, Massachusetts 44 years later. He had tuberculosis. One of the interesting things I read as I was reading all this stuff about him in preparation for tonight is the reason he had that funny beard that's just down here, and you see guys that had that very unattractive beard that sort of was a weird fashion statement. that people had TB, that was, they thought they were protecting their neck, and that was an, that was the way they wore their beard to protect their neck if they had TB. So that was interesting. Anyway, his family was not wealthy. They were modestly middle class. His father had a factory that made pencils, so that's right livelihood, right? So he was a very fine nature writer and observer. You could argue that he was among the very first published field ecologists. So when he died, his personal collection of natural history stuff, you know, plants and birds' nests and birds' eggs and so forth, and also his Native American collection, went to the Boston, what is it called, the Boston Society of Natural History. So it's like the Field Museum of Boston. And plants alone, there were over 1,000. They were all pressed, labeled, and numbered. And his antiquities, his Native American antiquities that he had just found on his many miles of walking in Concord, some of them were stone tools. So he was a very serious naturalist. When he and a friend accidentally burned down 300 acres of woods, because I guess they had a campfire and it was pretty dry, and at first he was pretty horrified, and they were very mean to him, I guess, as he was walking around Concord, as he would walk by, they would say, like, woods burner, like, it was like a nasty thing. Anyway, he was sorry about it, but interestingly, because he walked those woods all the time, he observed the effects that the fire had on the landscape, and he wrote possibly the first essay ever written about the positive effect of fire on natural landscapes of North America, which is really something that ecologists are still just learning about today. So that's pretty impressive. So those are his sort of naturalist credentials. And they come from direct experience because he spent so much time, not reading books. I did read books, but he spent so much time in the field directly observing. Also, he was a radical, fierce social activist. So the most important spiritual, moral crisis of his time was slavery. And, I mean, he died, the Civil War was still underway. And opposing slavery, he saw that as a moral imperative, and he wrote many anti-slavery essays. I listened to one on a recorded book in my car this past week, and it was interesting to hear it spoken instead of reading it. This one was about John Brown and his raid on Harper's Ferry, which, of course, I'm sure you know, was unsuccessful. People died. John Brown was hanged for treason. The press vilified John Brown, not just the press of the South, but the North as well. Well, Thoreau's essay from his Christian tradition compared John Brown to Christ and just extolled his courage and his brilliance and his sacrifice, and he just excoriated particularly the state of Massachusetts and the governor, naming names, for going along with, I mean, the South was not the only participant in slavery. The Fugitive Slave Act, which was passed in his lifetime required that someone who had escaped the South and was traveling through the North to Canada must be returned, and his writings on this, on the immorality of that, was just unbelievably strong. His family home was a Underground Railroad stopover place, and there are lots of other actions. And if you read Gandhi's biography and Dr. King's biography, they both say that that Thoreau's writings were strong inspiration for their nonviolent social action. So that's two sides of this man. Yeah, he had lots of other stuff. He was an inventor. I mentioned his father had this pencil factory. Well, he went and looked and studied graphite and figured out how to make it better. And so the pencils were the best pencils in the country. And he was Concord's land surveyor. That's how he made his living, was surveying land. And he was basically like a handyman to such people as Emerson and Hawthorne and the Alcotts and so forth, and he would do home repair and gardening and so forth. So that's basically who he was. But most importantly, he was a writer, and that's how we know him. He kept journals he lived for 44 years. He kept journals for 24 years. They're published. It's over 2 million words. He started keeping a journal because Emerson told him it would be a good idea, and he just kept doing it. And he's also written essays and poems and tons of natural history stuff. So he's been a personal hero of mine, I would say, ever since my earliest inklings of awakening to opening myself up to awakening thoughts. It's hard to put that kind of thing in language. His legacy has been a bit tarnished, which I guess happens to everyone, the best of us. He's been described as a genuine American weirdo, which I guess is not entirely bad. I visited Walden Pond in the late 60s, and it didn't look that great to me. It wasn't like going to where John Muir wrote about, you know, these magnificent places. It was really sort of this dumpy little pond with a lot of weeds and litter and so forth. And then we learned that he wasn't really there by himself. After all, you know, Walden was really pretty close to Concord, and he used to go home for dinner every Sunday and bring his laundry so his mother could do it, and people would come for parties, and, you know, he always said he had three chairs, one for himself, one for, I forget the whole thing, but, you know, he had people there. And there's actually been some pretty harsh stuff written about him. The New Yorker had one about 5 years ago that called him a self-indulgent, narcissistic, middle-class, Harvard-educated, well, the writer of the piece was also an Ivy League person, but anyway, etc. And, you know, there have been responses to that. When he was at Harvard, he wasn't one of the rich kids. In fact, your requirement was you had to wear a black jacket, and he couldn't afford a second jacket. His only jacket was green, so he had to get a special note from the dean or something in the administration saying it was okay for him to wear his green jacket, I guess, to dinner, so everyone knew he was like a poor kid. But I think we can think of Thoreau's life as kind of a koan. You know, it's just something to sit with. Here's a man who lived these 44 years, did a lot of amazing things, wrote a lot of amazing things, and I just want to read some of his words to you. Some of these are really well-known words and some less so. So in Walden he wrote, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. And if it proved to be mean, why then, to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world. Or, if it were sublime, to know it by experience and be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion." He was a meditator. He wrote this about meditation, although they didn't call it meditation. "Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sing around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun falling at my west window or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time." He didn't have someone ringing a bell for him. "I grew in those seasons like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands would have been. They were not time subtracted from my life, but so much over and above my usual allowance. I realized what the Orientals mean by contemplation and the forsaking of works. For the most part, I minded not how the hours went. The day advanced as if to light some work of mine. It was morning, and lo, now it is evening, and nothing memorable is accomplished." One more. So he wasn't a strict vegetarian, but he did write about meat eating. This is sort of funny. "One farmer says to me, 'You cannot live on vegetable foods solely, for it furnishes nothing to make bones with.' And so he religiously devotes part of his day to supplying his system with the raw material of bones, walking all the while he talks behind his oxen, which, with vegetable-made bones, jerk him and his lumbering plow along in spite of every obstacle." So these are just a few quotes, and you know, you can pretty much open one of his things at random and put your finger down and find something quotable. He's brought us a lot of wisdom and a lot of clarity. And I have to say, I've always been personally attracted to this idea of spending part of one's life alone, whether you call it, you know, hermit or whatever you want to call it. Like, I love Glenn Gould, and I love J.D. Salinger and Emily Dickinson. It's just an affinity of mine. And for these people, it always feels to me like some part of their genius or their originality is connected to this, you know, them separating themselves from the mainstream and spend time alone. There's a book by Red Pine called Road to Heaven, Encounters with Chinese Hermits. And in this book, he's fantastic. If you haven't read Red Pine, I really recommend it. But he spent time in the mountains in central China interviewing people who've spent 50, 70, they claim hundreds of years, you know, meditating in the mountains. And it's great, but he actually ends his book with a chapter called When the Tao Comes to Town, in which he describes this temple in this town where he finds like 50 or 60 hermits living in town, and they call themselves hermits. And so Red Pine says, he remembers this Chinese saying, the small hermit lives in a mountain, the great hermit lives in town. And I have to say, when I read that, I thought about Thoreau. You know, it's like, he's just this hermit living in town. And you know, here we are, we're in town, we're meditating, we're in town, we're here on Irving Park Avenue. I feel like there's something we can learn from his example and from his life. I can't wait to read this book. I ordered it on Amazon. It's very, very, you know how you want it immediately. It's coming very slowly. But I feel like when I think about him and his life, I feel like Reb Anderson said, you know, it's like, in some ways, I just want to be like him. So that's my talk. I think I went on too long. It's 8:30. I'd love to hear any comments or questions or thoughts. And I sure hope the machine taped it, because I'll be in big trouble if it didn't. And there's only two women in the room tonight. Wow. Thank you for coming. That's unusual. Yes.
Thanks for your talk. I hadn't heard that quote about thinking about Thoreau as like a performance artist, and life as a composition, which I think was a wonderful quote. And I think maybe it makes sense, the way in which he lived in Walden, that really isn't that far from Concord.
No.
I lived in Cambridge for a long time, and I would ride my bike to Walden and swim in the pond, and it's kind of nice.
They've cleaned it up. Since the 60s, yeah, there's a not-for-profit that took it over, and they've made it much nicer. For a while, it was pretty shabby.
But it makes sense in some ways that he was removed, but close enough that other people could sort of see and witness and participate in him being removed too. I mean, it gives that debate about, well, you know, he had Sunday dinner with his parents, kind of a different set of meanings to it. So, thanks. It's interesting to think about his being away, kind of deliberately and drawing people's attention to it.
It really is interesting. I never understood why people criticize him for going home on Sundays. It just seemed like such a wholesome thing to do. It's not like he was going to a bar or anything. Family probably liked him.
Yeah. I was really struck with the something you quoted in the very first lines before you talked about this decision to live deliberately. Yeah, and paying attention to the consequences, your moral consequences of your actions.
Mm-hmm.
And that part, completely resonates with the idea of leaving with intention, living according to vow. You kind of wonder, I suppose if you were around today, he would possibly be kind of a thorn in the side of American Buddhism, he's really good critical edge to him, but that part just seems so you wonder how he would have done had he been able to find a community of like-minded people. Didn't be wrong with someone, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, in some ways he did have a community of like-minded people. I mean, he spent a lot of time with the Emersons and some of those other people. And they were transcendentalists. You know, that's why they did the Unitarian Church and that kind of stuff. So it's not like he was completely out there on his own. I think Emerson was a huge influence on him. Emerson, another spectacular human being. Oh, my goodness. But yeah, how would he do today? Oh boy, would he write some good tweets to Donald, don't you think? Yeah. Thank you. Dave.
Yeah, so I have two comments. They're for a lot of people in the room. One's about John Brown, and the other's about just how we recognize or see resistance. So this is in no way diminishing or taking down the contributions that John Brown had to the end of slavery, but there are lots of slavery uprisings from slaves throughout the time. Slavery is occurring, led by people of color, and it's important to know and recognize those occurrences when they happen. Second is that this idea, I just want to talk about performance art and resistance.
Could we finish John Brown first? Because that's
sure.
Really interesting what you said. We'll talk about both things, but I have a question.
Yeah.
So there were lots of slave uprisings. But I think the thing about the John Brown one was somehow it got a lot of media attention, so it was more influential, not because it was any more successful or John Brown was any, better, but that somehow, just the fact that he and other people were writing so much about it, it's sort of like the media now.
I think there's a reason why it got more media attention.
Aha, interesting.
So do you recognize that as a corrective to the history that was needed when people were in the public support?
I think that led to a lot of like panic because it was like, oh, well, now we're actually someone who's not a person of color that is, starting this. And that's, so that's important for us to recognize. The second thing about resistance and performance art. And this is similar, where I think performance art can have a positive effect and can change, or having demonstrated sort of lifestyle, or having something like throughout the, as a way that change occurs, or something to make people think about their circumstances and their ways of life. But I also think it's important that there's a lot of forms of resistance that a lot of times white folks don't see. That they're, for a lot of us in Chicago right now, getting to the age of 25 and not being shot or being in prison is an expression of resistance. And anything, and a lot of things that you do on top of that are additional forms of resistance. But, and like living the life that you want a lot of times for a lot of folks in Chicago is a form of resistance as well. So I think it's important to see that sometimes we can have I think sometimes it's appropriate to expand the way that we see how resistance is lived in our communities as we struggle to get closer to what freedom actually means.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name.
I like your talk. I also have heard about throughout my whole life growing up, and my mom had sort of an intellectual crush on me. She's gay, I figured, but something transcends those definitions. And I see you come across the differences that perhaps we've over amplified Thoreau's impact. Maybe he's kind of the original hipster. And then that's a different thing to say, like why that kind of bothers us on some level. I think that's a whole other conversation I have with myself sometimes. What about that since it's sticking and crawl? Like you said, it's seems to me that you guys haven't done it long. But the part that you mentioned, it's a quote I haven't heard yet, but it really left an impact on things that you really think about for a while. Because it's just sort of damn brave and frankly inspiring. It's a bit about messing with life, and it's really, really scary, and it beats me up. I want to experience that as fully as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is sublime and transcendent, I want to experience that as fully as possible, and not for his own sort of happy feeling feelings he gets, but in both cases, he says, so that I can not.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can, you know, sort of create shared meaning with other people about this reality, this life. It's burbling under the surface while not paying attention, while we're like checking Instagram or whatever we're doing. And then kind of thinking about that, that fearlessness and that willingness of life on life's terms, in this love to this level of commitment that frankly kind of scares me. It's scary now. My back, so I go, oh, this is what's uncomfortable. What if I get like a snack? I get caffeine headaches if I don't have caffeine every day at 10 a.m. Like, is it going to be $5? Is it Wi-Fi?
Thinking about the implications of having that level of willingness to surrender a life like that, and then combining that with our thoughts about what does it mean to live in the world, not as a hermit out in the middle of nowhere where you're just having a transcendental experience, but what does it mean to try and access the universe on that level on a second-to-second basis with that level of willingness while you are taking out the trash and acknowledging the pain of people who don't look like you in your city that are systematically going to jail, and like what do you do with that as a white person, and how does that connect to sitting and experiencing life on the cushion while you're like, I'm going to focus on my breath for 3 minutes. Like trying to connect those dots. I don't know, that was a comment in process. I don't know if that makes sense, but thank you very much for sharing that.
Yeah, thanks for your comments. I mean, that's the koan part of him. It's like, oh, here's a guy who, he said he walked 5 miles a day for like 3 weeks or something because he was doing this phenology of plants and he had to see which day the flower opened. And it was 5 miles from his cabin or something. He's like, well, it wasn't open that day. Well, it wasn't. He does that at the same time that he's really putting as much as he can into social justice stuff. I mean, it's just an interesting combination in one human being. That, could arguably, the way I would put it is, that's what an awakened being does. They're just aware of all of that stuff. It's all there. So, I'm sorry, you wanted to say something.
Yes.
Say your name,
thank
too.
You. I'm Russ.
Russ.
Thank you again for your time. It's great. Thank you. And I wanted to follow up with something this gentleman said, which was the same passage struck me as well, in that sometimes it's hard, and I think we're encouraged in life not to really be in a deep way with the things that are painful and uncomfortable and which we find, which we have a visceral reaction against. Our first instinct is to fight, fight them or deny them.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they need to be fought. By starting by just trying to be with them and understand them.
Mm-hmm.
And once perhaps we can understand the difficult aspects of life at the level, we can figure out better how to deal with it.
Thank you. What is the, I'm sorry, take a little.
You mentioned that you try to find yourself.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
What is your method for?
My method for finding bodhisattvas? So a bodhisattva, so I would say a bodhisattva is an awakened being. My method for finding them, what a good question. I should have a method. I'd probably find more of them. I guess paying attention. I mean, in some ways, you know, there's some bodhisattva in everyone, you could say. So paying attention to that, looking for that, hoping for that. In some ways, bodhisattvas just manifest themselves in your life. And if you're ready for them, you know, then you notice them, I guess. I'm not sure how to answer that question. I'll think about that more. Because, I mean, I don't think, you know, the world is divided into bodhisattvas and not bodhisattvas. You know, it's like, it's not like a blood type or something like that where you get a test for it and okay, you're one. I'm just trying to be lighthearted about it. But to make the point that, you know, it's not, I mean, in some ways it may depend on context and, and what your needs are, or what your interests are, what your affinities are. That's a good question, though. I'll think about that. Other people have a better answer than that. I'm obviously struggling here. How do you find bodhisattvas, Matt? Yeah.
If you need something, they appear. And he was, I think you're making the point, like there are bodhisattvas who are, you know, they're burying bodies right now for us. They are tending to gardens. They are fixing our streets. They are, and his point is like most of the time they don't know they are doing this, but there's some way that, like you're saying, that all of us everywhere there's bodhisattva activity. I don't know if that's the same definition as like a bodhisattva that
right.
We're talking about, but
right.
I think his point was it's bigger than just like a person. It's
right.
It's more like activity that is arising all around us that we don't acknowledge all the time. He said it much better than I did, so you should listen to the talk.
But I know that was very well stated, and it helps me to think that, you know, the more part of fostering bodhisattva activity is noticing it and recognizing it and acknowledging it and appreciating it. So, and bowing to it or whatever we do. So, yeah, so that's a really good question. That sounds like a good Dharma talk.